From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Two of Georgia's finest creative minds join us today. One is a Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist. The other is a best-selling crime novelist who sets her stories in the Peach State.
She had told herself when she put on her sweatpants this morning that she was going to the gym. And she had gone near the gym, but only because there was a Starbucks in the parking lot. Thanksgiving was around the corner. The weather was freezing cold. Lydia had taken a rare day off from work. She deserved to start it with a pumpkin caramel spiced latte. And she needed the caffeine.
That's coming up this hour. First, though, an announcement. A very special guest joins us tomorrow. Atlanta rapper Killer Mike found his voice through hip-hop and then again through politics.
Before I was a rapper, I was a son of Atlanta. Before I ever wrote one rhyming word on paper, before that, I was a black man in America. And before I ever learned how to dance a jig, I gave a damn about American politics. I gave a damn about the people of America, and I took to the streets and I advocated.
Killer Mike has been perhaps the most vocal supporter of presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. He's minced no words in opposition of Hillary Clinton. We'll talk to him about why and who he'll give his vote to should Sanders lose the Democratic nomination. But what would you ask Killer Mike? What's your question? Here's your chance to send that question to us for one of Georgia's most famous artists and activists. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might get to your questions for Killer Mike on the show. When non-citizens in the U.S. are convicted of a crime, they often go through two separate justice systems. One is a criminal court. Many of us know about that. The other is immigration court. That's where a judge can decide to have someone deported. In the Lumpkin, Georgia immigration court, nearly all of the cases that come into the courtroom result in deportations. That's according to an analysis from Syracuse University. NPR investigative reporter Caitlin Dickinson traveled to Lumpkin to meet a man who's awaiting his fate in immigration court. And Caitlin's report is part of NPR's Embedded podcast. She joins me from Washington, D.C. Hi, Caitlin. It's good to talk to you again.
Hi, Celeste. You too. Thanks for having me.
What is the concept behind embedded? What does that mean when you say a reporter is embedded?
Ah, okay. So for embedded, the sort of tagline that we use is that we take a story from the news and go deep. So we go somewhere that you've heard about in the headlines over the last year or so, and you sort of hear a bunch of stories out of that area at once, and then that's it. We want to kind of go there and sit there and hang out for a while and understand a more full picture. So earlier this year, you heard a lot about deportation raids that the Obama administration carried out as part of its immigration enforcement agenda. And I wanted to understand, okay, so people are being picked up at their homes, but then what happens next? And so that's why I went to embed in a Georgia immigration court.
And you focused on one person's story in particular. That's Sean. He came to the U.S. legally from Guyana when he was 10 years old. He and his wife and three kids live in and have lived in Georgia, but he was arrested in 2011. Tell me a little bit more about Sean and how he ended up in this court in Lumpkin.
Sure. So like you said, Sean's been in the U.S. since he was 10, since he was a kid. When he was in his 20s, he actually, he says he was a recreational pot smoker his whole life. That's how he describes it. And when he was in his 20s, he had two misdemeanor convictions for possession of pot. And those did not impact his immigration status until much later they came into play. What put him in court in Lumpkin was that in 2011, he was arrested with 4 ounces of marijuana. And he was charged with possession with intent to distribute. He also had digital scales and plastic baggies at home, evidence the police said suggested he was selling drugs. So he was convicted on that charge. He pled out and he served 17 months. But that criminal conviction, it violated his immigration status because he'd been a green card holder all his life. He was a legal permanent resident, but he didn't apply for citizenship. So that 2011 conviction, again, put him into immigration proceedings, and that's why he was in Lumpkin.
All right, so let's take a listen. And just a warning for listeners, this is official government audio. The sound quality isn't that great, but this is from the trial. And you hear government prosecutor Reed McKee bring up past criminal charges that did not lead to convictions.
Now, sir, looking at your arrest history, a person might draw the inference, since you've been arrested in 4 different states for possession with intent to distribute drug crimes that you had been dealing drugs. Have you ever dealt drugs in the United States?
No, sir. I'm going to object to that question.
Now, the second voice we hear is Shah's defense attorney, Julio Moreno. Why is that? That is not something we would normally hear in a court most people visit. What's exceptional there?
Exactly. So throughout the story, there's sort of a theme of the differences between criminal and immigration law. And a big one is that in a criminal courtroom, there are a lot of actually rules about what sort of evidence you can introduce. And something like a past criminal charge that's going to make a defendant look really, really bad in front of either the judge or the jury, there's an extremely high bar to introduce something like that in criminal court because it's just a charge. It was never a conviction. But as I mentioned earlier, Sean had these earlier two misdemeanor convictions for possession of pot. In each case, he had initially been charged with intent to distribute, and those charges were dropped. Because the rules around evidence don't exist in immigration court, a government prosecutor can kind of bring up whatever they want. And so that this prosecutor in Sean's hearing chose to bring up those earlier charges as part of his bigger argument that Sean was a repeat offender, that he was a drug dealer, and that he should be deported.
And you also spoke for your story with Sean's attorney, Julio Moreno. Part of what you were talking about is that this difference in the standards of justice for a U.S. citizen versus someone who's an immigrant, et cetera, et cetera. And here's what he has to say.
Definitely, I wish the system would change to safeguard people's rights. The way the system is set up now, they're set up to fail, and they don't really have a chance of winning a case or remain here in the U.S.
Now, Caitlin, I get that part of the purpose of doing an embedded report is to really see for yourself, right? To look behind the headlines and judge for yourself what mm-hmm. you see. Would you agree that in some ways the system is set up so that people fail?
I don't know that I would characterize it that way. What I would say is that there are lots of things that are actually expressly called rights and protections that are given to people in the U.S. who are facing criminal charges, and they're not given to people who are facing immigration charges. And the other thing that I saw was that, you know, the reason for these differences, it has to do with a Supreme Court decision that was initially decided in the 1800s, and it's been upheld many times since then, that found basically the stakes just aren't as high as they are in criminal court, that when we deport someone, we're not punishing them. We're just sending them back to where they rightfully belong. That's the justification for these fundamental differences. And what I saw in Lumpkin was that, you know, for people like Sean, who is 40 years old, who's lived in the U.S. since he was 10 years old, has three U.S. citizen children, has a whole extended family here, and for people like asylum seekers who are fleeing violence in their home country, you know, I think the stakes are really as high as they come in immigration court. And so I think that's a good question to raise.
My guest is NPR investigative reporter Caitlin Dickerson. She recently visited an immigration court in Lumpkin, Georgia, to get a view of how it operates. This is part of NPR's Embedded podcast. And we did reach out to the U.S. Department of Justice for a comment. Its Executive Office for Immigration Review oversees immigration courts, and a spokesman says the department does not comment on immigration judge decisions or third-party reports on immigration proceedings. We reached out to the Georgia Department of Corrections as well and did not get a response. Caitlin, part of your reporting is this particular court in Lumpkin, and I assume the reason that you were there is the high percentage of people who get deported. Now, I looked at the ICE standards, and they said that actually, at this point, it's 50% or fewer cases that come before an immigration court end up in deportation. Did you get any insight into why Lumpkin's percentage is so much higher?
I did, yeah. So there are a few reasons. One is that Lumpkin is in the 11th Federal Circuit, so immigration court decisions are dictated by precedent, by what other federal courts in the region have decided on whatever is at issue. And Georgia is in, you may or may not know, one of the toughest federal circuits in the country on immigration. So in other words, judges in Lumpkin have guidance that is tougher than it is, say, in California or in New York. That's one reason. Another is that in Lumpkin, all of the immigrants who are being tried are in custody. They're detained. So that typically means that, you know, it's more likely that they have a criminal history, which is why they may or may not have been able to get out on a bond. So there are other immigration courts where they're seeing both people who are in custody and those who aren't. In Lumpkin, you're more likely to have a criminal record, and so that can be another reason. And so that probably accounts for some of the big difference. You know, 97.7% of people are deported in Lumpkin, but there's also a big element of discretion in immigration court decisions. And so it's really hard to tell whether those two things I just mentioned account for the entire difference or if there's some difference in discretion as well that factors in.
And I should mention that ICE stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Yes.
We spoke with Azadeh Shashahani. She's the legal and advocacy director with the Atlanta-based group Project South. And she used to oversee the National Lawyers Guild and worked with Georgia's ACLU. She says that this data that came from Syracuse University actually is concerning about our state.
Georgia generally has a very high deportation rate for a non-border state. Texas is number one, California is number two, and Georgia is number three, which, you know, really should raise eyebrows for a non-border state. Why do we have such high deportation numbers?
I think part of what makes your report a kind of eye-opening is that while you're embedded, it really does kind of take us behind the impact of some of these decisions. I mean, you read these percentages and the number of removals, and the number of deportations has actually fallen since a high in 2012. But then you get these scenes like this. This is Julio Moreno talking to Sean's family after it was decided. The judge said that Sean was going to be deported.
And hopefully we have a better judge to review the whole case. Everybody's conceding that he has been convicted.
Yeah, of course.
But the whole point of this defense is that he's changed and he's ready to make a full change in his life. So,
judge is heartless. You know, all we're saying that give him another chance. Give him a chance.
What is he going to do again?
That
what
Sean
is she going to do there? I
would have changed. He changed.
Where does Sean's case stand now?
Sean appealed to the immigration courts after that day, and he lost his appeal just recently. So he's sitting right now in detention, and he'll be deported to Guyana any day. So his family, who you heard in that clip, is just kind of trying to figure out what's next.
What did you learn? I mean, you're a journalist, and you've been a journalist for quite some time, which means you've done a lot of reporting on immigration. But what did you learn that perhaps surprised you?
I think the discretionary piece of immigration court decisions was probably one of the most interesting takeaways for me, which is that, you know, in a criminal court, there's a legal question at issue, and you've got to present evidence, and you've got to help either convince a judge or a jury that you've made a strong enough case. And that's true in immigration court. But then there's this second higher test that can be really hard to figure out. So in that clip, right before the family starts crying, Julio's explaining to the family, you know, we had all this evidence. We tried to convince the judge that Sean was a good guy, that he'd rehabilitated himself. We thought we had enough, but clearly we were wrong. And that's because ultimately it really is a subjective decision at the hands of the judge. And as I said before, there's just so much at stake for people like Sean and his family.
That is NPR investigative reporter Caitlin Dickerson. To hear all of her coverage about the immigration court in Lumpkin, Georgia, you can visit gpbnews.org. We have a link there to NPR's embedded podcast. Caitlin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This is On Second Thought. Georgia native and crime writer Karen Slaughter is the author of a number of international bestsellers. Her latest book is called Pretty Girls. It's about two women whose teenage sister vanished without a trace years before. And the paperback edition of the book came out last week. Karen Slaughter joins me now. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a dark book.
Yes, but I think there's also some lightness to it as well.
So let's talk about where you find the lightness, and it's going to be very difficult because there's spoilers almost immediately in the book.
It's true.
Which I don't want to give any of them away, which kind of reduces us to what, the first...
2 pages?
Yeah. Exactly. But let's talk about where you find the lightness, which I'm assuming is in the relationship between these two girls and... I guess the finding of healing. Where did you find it?
Well, you know, I'm the youngest of three girls, and most of my stories when I was a little girl were about my sisters disappearing or being murdered or getting in trouble, and then my parents loved me the best, which, you know, probably they did love me best anyway. So it was just sort of me writing that relationship. And in the book, Julia, the oldest sister, when she's 19 years old, she's a college student at UGA, and she just disappears. They have no idea what happened to her. And I wanted to explore what would happen to a family broken apart by a crime like that. So this was kind of my way to exorcise those demons.
Did your family, your sisters, or your parents read those stories you wrote about your sisters disappearing?
They did. And actually, I think today I'd probably be put on Ritalin or something, but... Actually, my teachers were very supportive, and they focused me into creative writing and really nurtured that weirdness in me. My best advice came from my ninth grade teacher, though, because she said, you can't kill everyone in your stories. You have to have some balance.
You are trying to kill all the people.
Exactly.
You were a young George R. R. Martin.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. My whole Red Wedding was like my whole ouvreur before I hit the ninth grade. But, you know, I do think that was an important lesson for me. You do have to balance some of that darkness with lightness. And in Pretty Girls, I use that relationship between the two remaining sisters and the family. And, you know, I love reading thrillers. It's my passion. And I'm never interested in that unrelenting darkness. So I always think about one of my favorite short stories by a good Georgia native, Flannery O'Connor, where she's talking about a serial killer named the Misfit, and a good man is,
hard to find.
And I love that line where the serial killer says about the grandmother that she would have been a good woman if someone had killed her every single day of her life, you know? And that's the kind of, I think, Southern humor and lightness that balances out some of that more dark material.
Why do you like reading thrillers? You know, oftentimes I'll talk to authors who write a certain genre of book, but that's not what they read in their off time.
Gosh, you know, I've heard people do that, and I understand it on some level because I'm lucky that a lot of thriller writers are my friends, and I don't want to read their book and think, oh, you know, I hate this, or I know Lee Child, and so sometimes
he wrote a great blurb for your
book.
Yeah,
he did, yeah. But sometimes I'll hear his voice instead of my voice for Jack Reacher, and I can understand that, but I mean... The thing that made me want to write thrillers and work on the puzzle of writing a mystery novel, I mean, the main thing that really put me on that road was reading Encyclopedia Brown or Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys, or, you know, I did take a detour into V.C. Andrews and all that as a teenager.
Flowers like, in the Attic.
Exactly,
yeah.
Or Lace.
Yes.
But, you know, once I got past all that drivel, I was back into reading thrillers. Sarah Paretsky, Sue Grafton, you know, so these were the types of books that made me want to really be a writer.
What does it take to be a really good thriller writer? I mean, when you're reading somebody else's work, what books do you, what do you read that makes you throw the book down in disgust? And what do you read where you say, wow, this is good?
Well, you know, primarily I'll start with the language in some of a friend of mine, Denise Mina, she's a Scottish crime writer. She's amazing. And the language in her books is so impeccable. I remember the last line I read of hers that just made me green with envy. She's talking about a character's watching the waves and describes the cresting waves like when you slice the top of a bag of sugar. And I mean, that was just so beautiful. And I hated her so much at that point, you know, it actually took me out of the book because I was like, I can't believe how great this is. So that's what excites me. What I hate is what everybody who reads thrillers hates is when it doesn't make sense, you know, or you think, you know, you're 10 pages away and you think, gosh, the writer just figured this out. And suddenly there's like a pubic hair that's found and they pick it up and put it under a microscope and someone says he was a left-handed killer. He hated his mother, you know, and I hate that. The only person I think that I can think of off the top of my head that can really do forensics well is Jeff Deaver. And that's because generally it's not the big solve. Is through a microscope, you know. So I like when the puzzle is there and they play fair with me and I can figure it out along the way. And when I get to the end, it's like, aha, instead of what the heck.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Karen Slaughter. She's an Atlanta native and an author of a number of bestsellers. Her latest is called Pretty Girls, and it's now out in paperback. I wonder if it ever gave you pause because you're such a strong writer and the writing has such integrity just as writing. And you worried you would not get the respect that, say, if you were writing adult fiction, right, that people think about? The reason I ask this is because I think about Stephen King, who's a brilliant, just a writer. And if you were writing anything other than horror, he might be taken differently in a scholarly sense. Did you ever give that any thought?
The genre doesn't matter so much to me. I mean, I didn't go into the genre thinking, oh, my God, that people aren't going to take me seriously. I kind of knew that as a thriller reader and as someone who studied Renaissance poetry in college, but still people couldn't believe if I had a Stephen King paperback, you know, so something must be wrong with me. I'm not a serious literature person. But, you know, honestly, I mean, he's a perfect example. His characters are amazing. I would hold up Dolores Claiborne to any character, Faulkner, Hemingway, any of those guys. I mean, just an amazing character. And not least of all because it's somebody who's actually interested in writing about a well-developed woman. But for me, you know, I'm not really concerned so much with the genre. I do wish that thrillers were taken seriously, but we sell a heck of a lot. So it's kind of weird to complain that we're the best-selling genre, you know. And for me, I just think it's important to tell a story. And I would defy you to mention any book that has endured in the American canon that doesn't have some sort of crime or murder. I mean, Gone with the Wind, there is an extremely brutal and violent murder.
There is.
You know, when we watch it in the South on at the Fox, everybody hisses when the Yankee comes up into Tara, and there's Scarlett there, and she has her gun, and he's going through her mom's sewing box, and she shoots him in the face. And in the book, the way she describes the hole in his face, the blood trickling across the floor, and she actually says Scarlett wants to dance. She's barefoot. She wants to dance in his still warm blood. I mean, that's a thriller passage. So if that's a thriller, then I think I'm in good company.
But tell me a little bit about getting into the minds. I find it fascinating that people often ask crime writers, male crime writers, wow, you wrote a great female character. How did you get into the mind of the female? But they never ask females, wow, you wrote a great male character. How did you get into the mind of the male? But I find myself sometimes thinking, and not necessarily in this book, but in some of your other books, if there is anything that you do differently when you're writing a male character, because you do write them so well and so authentically.
Well, thank you. You know, I'll make a very blanket statement because obviously this doesn't apply to men and women universally. But when I'm writing Will Trent, for instance, he's much more of a let's not talk about the problem, let's solve the problem or pretend it's not even there. I think a lot of men have that in them, you know.
Problem solvers.
Right. They want to solve that problem. And what's the point of talking about it endlessly? And a lot of women feel like they need to talk it out. And I'm kind of a mixture of those two things, depending on the problem. That's why I'm saying it's a blanket statement. And I think Will is, too. You know, sometimes he wants to talk it out more, and usually he's talking to Faith, his partner. And I think at work, it's easier for him to talk things out with Faith than it is at home to talk things out with Sarah. Because with Sarah, he's more like, you know, kind of afraid to talk about how he feels about something because that might be a weakness and she might not be attracted to him anymore. And, you know, all that gets caught up in there. So yeah, those are the things I keep in mind. And I wrote a character, Jeffrey Tolliver, in my earlier books.
Sheriff.
And he was more of a touchy-feely kind of guy. But then I had him do things like beat up suspects and get in car accidents and shoot people and to kind of balance it out to make him manly. So Will was a response to that, thinking, well, let me do a different kind of guy character because there are a lot of different guys out there.
There's also, if we're speaking about authenticity, there's also clearly a great deal of authenticity in the places of your books. These are areas that you know very, very well, not just for Will Trent, but Grant County, and then some of those that take place. This book, Pretty Girls, well, they drive a lot of different places. They kind of span a certain area of the state. And I wonder, have you ever wanted to write about another location, or is there something about really, really knowing a place intimately that helps you as a writer?
Well, yeah, I think it does help to know. You know, if you look at Bradbury, when he's writing about Mars.
Ray Bradbury, a science fiction
writer. Ray Bradbury. He's really writing about his hometown, right? And I think that we...
And Stephen King writing about Maine.
Exactly, yeah. So I really, when I started out, I made a conscious choice to write about Atlanta. And so this was, when I wrote this book, 18 years ago. So I was 12, basically. But it was a really kind of radical choice not to set it in Los Angeles or New York or some crimey place like that at the time. Nobody was really writing about Atlanta in a realistic criminal kind of way. So it was a choice on my part. And instead of writing about a big town, I wanted to write about a small town because that's what I grew up in. I grew up in Jonesboro, Georgia, which is a lot like Grant County. We had the junior college. That was our big claim to fame. And so I wanted to really kind of write what I know. But I think you should also write what you want to know. And I wanted to know more about crime. And, of course, I was in Jonesboro when the Atlanta child murders were going on. And so I remember very distinctively, you know, that time before the murders, before children were being targeted, before it was on the news all the time, before people were terrified. And then after, I wasn't allowed to go outside without my parents knowing where I was. And, you know, before that, literally, we would be locked out of the house in the summer because my mother couldn't stand us underfoot. And she's like, go outside and play. And if you get thirsty, there's the hose. And if you have to go to the bathroom, there's the woods. After that, I mean, our lives totally changed. It was just a really transformative time because of this crime occurring. And we know how far Jonesboro is from Atlanta, you know, especially then. I mean, 45 minutes was an eternity. Jonesboro was considered a very small town. But it did terrify us, and it changed how our community was. And so that's what I really wanted to write about. And so that's why I picked a small town.
Does crime still scare you? Do criminals still scare you?
Crime bothers me. Mass shootings bother me that generally, statistically, during these mass shootings, the first victim is a woman. It bothers me we don't talk about that. It bothers me we don't talk about the violence against women, that we'll talk about the 8% of cases where a woman falsely accuses someone of rape instead of the 92% where they don't. You know, that kind of thing bothers me, that we don't really look at crime for what it is and who it affects, that we don't look at the scourge of, you know, who we have imprisoned. Lives we've ruined with the industrial prison complex, that bothers me. I think if you worried about being a victim of crime, you'd never leave the house. So I try not to think about that. I try instead to think about we need to change things as opposed to taking a posture of we need to hide under the covers all the time.
Before we go, my last question for you would be the kind of crime that you're talking about, the crime that annoys you, is not the crime generally that would be a good thriller. Do you know what I mean? Like, you need a diabolical mind,
right?
That's the criminal's part in order to be a really good thriller. How is it even possible to turn that kind of crime into a good novel?
I think it is. You know, I mentioned Denise Mina. She's really good at talking about the crimes that are more realistic. I mean, let's face it. The crime I write about in Pretty Girls actually happens. It's based on something that was shared with me through a contact in law enforcement,
which is awful.
Which is awful. But Denise writes about and you know, Lisa Gardner does this sometimes too. Tess Gerritsen. Most criminals are really stupid, or they have made really bad choices, and they keep making bad choices after bad choice after bad choice, and they keep getting in trouble, and they keep digging and digging, trying to get out of that hole, and that's how they end up in trouble. And many of them, it's economic. You know, here in Georgia, we've privatized our parole system. So if you get out on parole and you can't afford to pay for this sudden drug testing that the parole company throws on you, even though it's not court mandated, you can end up back in jail. I mean, Georgia started out as a debtor's colony, and now we're going right back to imprisoning poor people like we're a debtor's colony again. So, you know, that kind of thing, while it's horrible, I couldn't really write a book about it. I have to pick the really big crimes, but I think there are ways and avenues within the story to mention this sort of thing. Because, like in my next book, which is out in September, called The Kept Woman, has Will Trent in it. I have Faith, his partner, has worked the Atlanta cheating scandal, right? The Atlanta public schools cheating scandal. Yeah. And she's talking about this one school, and she mentions that if this had been, so this is like a 99.5% minority school, right? And she says, of course, if this had been a white school, the cheating never would have happened. and no one would have paid attention. You know, it just would not be an issue. And that's the kind of thing I like to talk about in my books, is to slip in these little social issues that might make people think. But then I have to write a nice, juicy thriller for them to actually want to read the story.
And you do, I'm not going to say who, but one of the characters is on parole, so it kind of slips in there a little
yes.
bit. Karen Slaughter is an Atlanta crime author. Her new book, Pretty Girls, is now available in paperback. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. ...2016 is the centennial year of the Pulitzer Prize. That honor has been awarded to dozens of people who are from Georgia or live in Georgia. And so we'll spend some time with past winners all this year. It's a new series we're calling Pulitzer Peaches. And you might know our first guest from his satirical cartoons in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Mike Lekovich has worked at the AJC since 1989. He won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning twice, in 1998 and in 2002. Mike, it's a pleasure. Welcome.
Hi, hey Celeste, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. First of all, you've come a long way for an insurance salesman.
Right.
That's quite the journey.
Yeah.
But I wonder, what kind of difference does it give you, or how does it change your ability as an artist if you become a full-time cartoonist? Because a lot of cartoonists are still freelance, and they'll be that way their whole lives.
Right.
So what changes when you become full-time?
Well, you know, it's, when you're full-time, you're very fortunate, for one thing, because it's like the funnest job there is. I mean, to be able to comment on what's going on in the world, to comment on things that I find that are important to me and to my family, and to be able to do it hopefully in a humorous way, and to be able to draw. I mean, drawing is my favorite hobby, so to be able to do that as a profession, it's really incredible. And, you know, and then winning the Pulitzer, that's sort of like frosting on the cake, because, you know, you occasionally get an award and people make, you know, they get very excited for you, and that's just such a fun thing. But the real fun thing for me is every day to be able to come in and look at what's going on in the news and to try and come up with the best idea that I can. Now, today, you know, Mondays are always my toughest day, because the news really hasn't really gotten going. And so I come in and I haven't been thinking about the news during the weekend. So it's always sort of a challenge on Mondays. And I'm always so happy when Monday's over and I have my cartoon, because it gets easier as the week goes on.
So I wanted to talk about giving offense. You've talked pretty openly about the number of angry messages you get, even death threats, right?
Yeah, right.
And we actually have a listener who has called you a vicious partisan, and says those are the ideal Pulitzer candidates. That's that person's opinion. That's from T-Barf. But this is fairly regular for you. I wonder if that has increased since the onset of social media.
Well, I do get a lot more comments now. You know, my cartoons, when I do a cartoon, I immediately post it on Facebook, and it also goes on Twitter. So people can go to M. Lekovich AJC on Facebook and see my cartoons every day. But so as soon as they're posted, almost immediately people start commenting, and you just get this. I mean, I love it. I even the negative comments.
Truly?
Oh yeah. No, I like people weighing in. I have other cartoonist friends of mine who really dislike it. They feel like, you know, if they're criticized, they feel bad. Maybe I'm just a little bit off, but I like when people are PO'd at me. I mean, it's like I feel like, you know, they may not agree with me, but at least they're paying attention. And so it's really been a great thing social media has.
Although one of the most controversial cartoons that you drew was one that you drew after Michael Jackson's death, and basically one of the biggest complaints, it was just too soon. And right. I wonder if there is a time in your mind when it is too soon, especially after a death.
Yeah. Well, now the cartoon you're talking about, I think it, you know, it's been a while ago, but I believe it was the devil and I think God, and they're trying to decide
which way he should go, to heaven
yeah,
or
which
to
way
hell.
He should yeah. go. Yeah, you know, based on the
the allegations,
yeah, the pedophilia allegations. And, you know, first of all, Michael Jackson is my favorite entertainer of all time. I love his music. And, you know, I think he was in some ways a very damaged person. But all that aside, you know, when something big happens like his passing or a little over a week ago, Prince's passing, you know, you want as a cartoonist and as a journalist to be able to get on that issue as quickly as possible. And, for instance, the one I did on Prince, another entertainer whom I loved, I thought he was so great. So when I found out that he had passed away, I immediately came up with the idea, and within an hour, I had the thing drawn, and I put it on Facebook. And that was like the fastest I've ever come up with an idea before. But I wanted to get it out there, partly because I thought it might be an idea that other people would do. I drew a couple of doves.
Yeah, it's a beautiful
crying,
on a purple background, and there's two doves actually crying. It's very moving. But I can't imagine anyone in Prince's family being offended by that.
No. I mean, you know, Prince. You know, there's a guy like Michael Jackson, where he had lawsuits and things. I mean, you know, you have to take each person or each issue and weigh it. You know, everything is different, and that's what makes the job so interesting to me.
So I read an interview that you did after you won your first Pulitzer, and you said that the editorial writers at the AJC look at you strangely because, quote, they don't really understand what I do and vice versa. I assume that you're talking about the columnists. What do you mean that you guys don't understand what each other does?
Well, you know, I think I have more of an understanding of what they do than they understand. They can't put into words. They can't do what I do, boiling a subject down to its essence and drawing about it. I'm not bragging. It's just a weird. You know, it's like the only talent that I really have in this life is being able to do this. And you know, the columnists at the AJC, they are great at what they do, but they just can't do that. Now, I could probably write a column, but it wouldn't be a very good column. So we each have our strengths, I think.
So how did you end? I mean, there are artists, people who can draw, who don't end up drawing cartoons. What is the qualifying minimum standards that you need to be an editorial cartoonist beyond artistic ability?
Yeah. You know, I think, I mean, just like in any profession, there are people that are better than others, but I think you have to have an ability to, make a point using, in a clever or somewhat humorous way. You have to have a somewhat of an ability to draw, I think. And for me, even as a kid, like, you know, in elementary school and all through school, it was always cartooning. I mean, I couldn't, you know, in high school, they, you know, you'd have to draw still lifes or something. And I would always, you know, want to make a cartoon out of it. I met my wife in college, and we were drawing, it was in art class, and we were drawing nudes. And so I was drawing these caricatures. I mean, you know, naked people, there are plenty of things that you can cartoon on a naked person.
Yes.
so my, you know, my now wife was looking at me, and she's thinking, what the heck is wrong with this person?
Didn't you get a C in that class?
I think I did. You know, I was lucky to get a C, I think.
If you're just joining us, my guest is two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Mike Lukovich of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And we also used a clip of you earlier saying that the golden era, at least for you as a cartoonist, was the Bush era, Bush 2.
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
Well, so much, and you know, I'm a cartoonist, and you know, this is my opinion, but so much of what he did was so stupid and wrong. You know, Iraq, torture, 9/11, Katrina, the the economic collapse. He will go down in history as one of our very worst presidents. And not only him, but you know, there was this cast of characters. You know, the Dark Lord Cheney, who is just like, you know, from central casting as the evil villain, Rumsfeld. All these, you know, all these characters that, you know, that are, to me, were not good people. And you know, I love that. I mean, it made my job so darn easy because I thought everything they were doing was incorrect.
This is probably a good moment to remind everybody that you are an editorial cartoonist,
yes.
Which means you don't have to be balanced, right?
No. And that's what's great. And what the AJC does is they run my cartoon. Underneath my cartoon, they run a cartoon, View from the Right. So it's two or three different right-wing editorial cartoonists. So, you know, they're trying to be balanced. But no, I'm a Democrat, and I have very strong feelings, and that's. But you want that with an editorial cartoonist. You don't want someone that just writes gags without a stance. You want someone that's going to be strong.
So let's go back, because you are our very first Pulitzer peach.
Okay.
Let's go back to talking about the Pulitzer of itself. You won two, and
yeah. And
I wonder, what is the best part of being a Pulitzer Prize winner? I read that you talked about the fact that when you won your first one, you couldn't get people out of your audience, your office. You couldn't even work. But what's the best part?
You know, as I said earlier, you know, just drawing is the funnest part. You know, winning the Pulitzer is like, it's like people... you know, your peers are recognizing that you're doing your very best, and it's just kind of like a celebration, and it's really fun. A month or so ago, there was a Pulitzer Centennial celebration in Washington D.C. at the museum, and so I went to that, and there were all kinds of Pulitzer winners, and so they took this big group photograph, and then what I did is I brought a 24 by 17, I think, piece of paper. And so I would bring it around to all these Pulitzer winners, and I would have them sign it the year they won and what the category they won for is. So now I have that, and I've got the photograph in the middle and all these signatures around. So I think that's kind of neat.
And you did that the second time you won also?
No, this was for the centennial celebration.
The event.
Yeah, it was the event. Yeah, so it was just like a month or a month and a half ago, and so I just thought, you know, there's going to be all these people in one room, so I'm gonna get all their signatures. So you know, so like I have signatures from like Nick Ute, who took the Vietnam War photo of the young girl that had just been napalmed.
Yeah,
all these amazing human beings all together. So that's just something that I'm gonna get framed and keep.
So when you got your first Pulitzer, you thought somebody was pranking you. You didn't take the call.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was all just one of my cartoonist friends giving me a hard time.
But so by the second one, you believed them by then, right? You took that
call? You know, that year I had done some cartoons that I thought were that I liked a lot, and so I thought I might have a chance at it. So I had more confidence the second time.
So who among the, and I'm looking at one of your cartoons recently, it's a cartoon of a Republican presidential debate, and you've got Jeb up there and Ben Carver, and you've got, Donald Trump. Who's the best one to draw? Is it Trump, because you draw his hair like going out way out to the side?
Yeah, well, you know, they were all, there was like how many at first? Many Republican candidates, and they were all a bunch of... weirdos and characters, so they were all fun to draw. But I think, you know, I really think Trump is the best with the hair, and you know, his mouth is always open. There's just something about him. What I do when I'm drawing him or any person that I'm drawing is I go to Google Images and I find the best image that I can, and it's on my computer. And I'm not sitting at a drawing table. I'm just sitting at a regular desk at my computer. And so I just look at that photograph, and then I draw. I do the drawing from that. So I don't pencil anything in first. So I have this whiteout pen, and I white out, and then I rub it with my finger. So I have whiteout all over. But that's how I do my drawing.
And we only have about a minute left, but I wonder what you think about the increasingly loud voice of comedy in our politics, because you're part of that. And some people say that shows like The Daily Show and stand-up comedians are where they're taking their political facts.
Yeah, right.
Any idea on why that is?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, it's entertaining. I mean, you'd rather get your information if you feel it's credible. You'd rather get it from someone that where it's kind of fun. Plus, you know, the I guess mainstream media. It's not, you know, it's always both sides are at fault, and it's not always both sides that are at fault. So sometimes with political humorists, you get more of a realistic take on what's actually occurring in our country.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. That is Mike Lukovich. He's the editorial cartoonist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He has won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. Mike, obviously congrats on 2 Pulitzers, but thank you so much.
Thanks, Celeste.